Thank you, Nora. I just want to remind everybody that although Arash, Katie, myself, and Robert are working at home, we're all connected by computers, Microsoft Teams, and our phones. Nora is still at the office. So this is interesting. We're having like a five-way kind of phone conversation with all of you. Just want to also remind people that if they want to hear some daily commentary, they can follow me on Twitter at Stephen Yamshon. I just want to say I have a lot to cover tonight. We'll leave plenty of time for questions and answers. I have studied this quite a bit, but I'm going to throw some commentary in there as we go along. So let's begin. The financial markets are in a state of shock because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and there are known and unknowns. What we don't know in regard to COVID-19 is the speed and the spread and the number of victims and deaths. We don't know when stocks will bottom. We don't know how much the economy will contract or how long the recession will be. We can only make guesstimates on that. We don't know how many people will lose their jobs or businesses go bust or mortgages go unpaid. Epidemiologists don't know if social distance will be enough to stop the spread with the U.S. No one knows how long a vaccine will take or how long drugs will to combat the virus will take. No doctor, Wall Street maven, or anyone else knows what is going to happen, especially in times of a crisis or when an economic tsunami looms. Only the arrogant thinks that they do. Since we base our decisions on facts and tend to be long-term investors, we underestimated the global health ramifications of the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan and the severity of a 2020 recession. We could not foresee the safe-in-place lockdown that would be imposed to slow COVID-19 spread. We recognize that the recession will be quite severe, but not as severe as some pundits think. The Federal Reserve is doing an incredible job backstopping credit markets and trying to ease liquidity roadblocks. Hopefully, Congress will pass legislation action for much-needed fiscal stimulus, but in-house bickering is delaying the action and causing precious time to be wasted. It is our guess that the full effect of the stimulus won't be felt until after the pandemic recedes. Significant unknowns are always at the center of any financial panic. This time is no different. Benjamin Graham pointed out that markets have a deeply entrenched tendency to overact. When an individual company begins to lose ground, Wall Street is quick to assume that the company is entirely worthless, should be avoided at any price, and thrown away. In contrast, Wall Street becomes too excited when a company that is entirely unproven, with no track record or earnings, comes to market, only to see many of them crash and burn later. In times of stress, the market overreacts at the market level and radiates to each and every stock, regardless if it is warranted or not. For example, in the last month, utility stocks, which are safe, have declined as much or even more than the others. And I would like to now point to chart 3 in your chart pack, if you have it. We can see that the ones that declined least were consumer staples, healthcare, information technology, and utilities is right in the middle. The financials, industrials, materials, and the S&P 500 declined even more. And, of course, energy declined the most, but that was mostly due to the Saudi-Russian oil price war that both of them have started. So utility stocks have declined. Although utility usage may decline by a small amount due to commercial usage, residential rates are more favorable than commercial ones, but the market didn't take that into account, that more people will be staying at home and using more electric power. So therefore, I still consider utility stocks a defensive position in which most of the counts, if not all of them, have utility stocks. In my opinion, and in most cases, the high dividends of utility stocks are safe. Yet the utility stocks decline with everything else. It makes no sense whatsoever, except to note that investors were indiscriminately dumping everything to raise cash, to pay off margin loans, or to run scared. It seems to me that there must be many sound stocks that are thrown out with the bathwater, such as hospitality, restaurant, and travel companies. These are not safe stocks, but others are. And we don't have any hospitality, restaurant, or travel company. This puts the investor's advantage into a disadvantage. If we take a look at chart two, this is the CBO put-call ratio. And what that really means is if people get scared, they write put, and if people are bullish, they write call. But we can see from the blue line that the call ratio is quite high. And then we can also see in chart six the indiscriminate stampede out of corporate credit. And we can see that even investment-grade bonds have declined as people have sold them. And then in chart seven, this also compares to the liquidity risk. The past week, there has been nothing short of a stampede out of bonds as investors dash for cash. According to Bloomberg, investors yanked $109 billion from investment-grade bonds funding ending the week of March 18, 2020. Another record was taken out the week before, and the municipal bond market had a similar pattern. Bond market liquidity has dried up. Investors have pulled more than one half of the assets in the Mellon Bank Dreyfus Money Market Fund in less than a week, necessitating Mellon to inject $1.5 billion. Goldman Sachs had to do the same thing, but injecting a little less than $1 billion. If Mellon and Goldman had not done so, the funds would most likely have broken the buck, in which investors would receive less than $1 they originally put into the fund. This would have been an echo of the past in 2008, if the Federal Reserve had not backstopped into commercial paper market. As an aside, 2 weeks ago, we had transferred all the money market funds into U.S. Treasury market funds, just as a precaution, as I had learned to do in 2008. So I feel that the money market funds are extremely safe if they're in the Treasury U.S. money market fund. The regular money market funds, now that the Fed has backstopped, doesn't really worry me at all either. Until yesterday, liquidity problems applied to gold as well. Gold dropped below $1,500 per ounce on Friday, March 20th. Fixed income and gold are not acting as safe havens as they're supposed to do. High yield or junk bonds have been the worst performers. The risk parity theory has broken down because almost everyone has a sell everything mindset. In regards to stocks, managers are forced to dump their stock holdings to accommodate redemptions, setting off a reinforcing feedback loop. Due to the passage of the Dodd-Frank regulation bill after the great financial crisis in 2008, banks no longer keep large inventories of bonds, in which brokers and banks act as market makers and holders of bond inventories. Banks and brokers are stepping away, forcing a liquidity squeeze that forces the sale of anything liquid. This caused a temporary spike in Treasury yields and a decline in bond prices. As gloomy as it sounds, it might not be as bad as one thinks. Over the past several days, I've been dusting off my financial history books and graduate school notes to see what parallels might be close to what we are experiencing. There is not much data in regards to financial markets in the time around 1918 when the Spanish influenza epidemic occurred because of the proximity to the ending of World War I when financial markets were already in disarray. However, there is plenty of history between 1900 and now. The major market downturns occurred in 1907, 1921, 1929 to 32, 1937, 1941, 1964, 1973 through 74, 1980, 1987, 1994, 1998, 2000 to 2003, 2008, and then December 2020. So you can really see that there have been plenty of major declines. But let's take a look at some of the bigger declines. From June 1907 to November 1907, when there was a banking panic in New York, when the Knickerbocker Trust Company failed and J.P. Morgan had to bail it out, the market was down 44%. From November 1916 to 1917, President Woodrow Wilson closed down the stock market for World War I, and the market was down 39%. From November 1919 to August 21, the market was down 47%. And from September 1929 to November 1929, which is the famous stock market crash, the market was down 48%. So to understand what the worst possible scenario that could happen, I am going to focus my research intentions on the period between 1929 and 1937. And the reason I'm doing this is this could be what would be the worst possible scenario, not my base case scenario, but the worst possible thing that could happen. By April 17th of 1930, the market had recovered 52% of the previous decline. It was at the beginning, back at the beginning of 1929. The market was only 23% below the high of that year in September 1929, and the decline in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, in my opinion, was not abnormal if we take a look, you know, at some of the prior year decline. If we look at the rallies and declines between March 1929 and 1932, the average loss would be 14%. If you had bought at the top of September 29 and you sold at the bottom of 1932, you would have lost 89% of your money. Looking at the gross national product, the output of national goods and services was 100, which is baseline, in December 1929, and one could see that the economy had not been affected. However, by December 1933, the GNP had dropped to 70, a decline of 30%. To me, in today's panic, anything that the forecasters claim will happen is suspect. This is because the banking system completely failed in 1932 through 1934 with a run on almost every bank in the country. Today, the banking system is backstopped, and the Fed will do whatever it takes. There is unemployment insurance and other safety nets like Medicare and Medi-Cal. This was not occurring in the 1930s. The huge monetary impact of deposit flight and destruction and the unwillingness of the Federal Reserve to counteract is the key reason why the U.S. Depression of 1931 developed into a depression. Banks react normally to deposit flight by selling their most liquid assets to bolster their bank balance sheet. This includes treasury, gold, corporates, and municipal bonds. The Federal Reserve has made it clear that they have learned from their mistakes of the past, and they will do whatever it takes to stabilize the financial system. This time, they have been very quick to act. Interestingly enough, seemingly defensive sectors of the stock market, such as food stocks, offer little protection because the stock market was overvalued by September 1929. While bond prices have been declining, they significantly outperformed stocks. Overvalued equities became undervalued within 3 years. Today, overvalued equities became fairly valued within 1 month. Stock prices dropped once again by the start of 1933, but improved greatly from 1933 to 1937, where there was a mild recession. The period between 1932 and 1937 was one of the greatest bull markets in U.S. history. The Dow Jones rose 370% during this period, when the best estimate of the Consumer Price Index showed an 11% rise in principal and level. This tells you that even if you had bought the top in 1929 and sold at the bottom in 1932 and lost 89% of your money, you would have gained 370% if you had bought at the bottom and held to 1937, which, in my opinion, to catch a bottom or a top is virtually impossible to do. Cumulatively, the Dow Jones declined by 89% from 1929 through 1932, as we mentioned. However, every investor who stuck it out was way ahead by 370% by 1937. In addition, an investor who invested at the bottom of 1932 secured an average dividend yield of 10%. However, if the investor had invested all of his money or her money in stocks without having a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds at the peak in 1929, it would have taken him a long time to get whole. If we average 20 major declines between 1900 and 2018, we would find that the average decline is approximately 40%, as measured by the DJIA. Until today, when the Dow Jones ran up approximately 11%, the DJIA was down approximately 36% through yesterday. So we can see that if the average decline is down 40%, the Dow Jones was probably not that far off from that 40%. Let's talk about lessons from history here. As I mentioned earlier, no one knows the extent and the magnitude of the pandemic virus. It's impossible to know what the ramifications on the economy will be. However, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, it could not be worse than the 1929 Depression. If that is the case, then the range of equity decline should be between 40 and 50%. A balanced portfolio like the kind that the majority of you have will be significantly less. However, this estimate is not certain. It's just an estimate because no one knows with any certainty. The Dow Jones Industrial Average as of Monday, March 23rd, was down 36%, like I said. It's up about 11% today, so that means that the cumulative loss is down 26%. This could possibly mean that the market is nearing a bottom. From the 36% decline, it is possible that the market could decline 10 or 15% more to reach the bottom. No one knows the exact figure. In my opinion, GDP could drop to a minus 30% at its worst, but I suspect it would be less than that because this coronavirus may prove to be shorter lived than the Great Depression. So we really don't know how long the coronavirus will last and how bad it will be. However, we can be pretty sure the world will not be the same, just like it wasn't after World War II, the great financial crisis, and any influenza of 1918. It will take a few years to get back to normal. The same is with the COVID-19. The investing public doesn't know what to believe. This is why investors attribute attitudes are bearish and the stock market has been so volatile. We don't know if the Western countries will take the tough action that is required and if the public will comply. And I just want to make an aside here. I was taking a walk down Bomber Canyon today, and you could still see people walking in groups and people bicycling in groups, not paying attention. So I'm not sure if the people will comply. I would have to go into the bushes to keep my 20 feet safe distance. People have a very hard time dealing with uncertainty, especially when the stakes are so high. So we have a game plan, and I want to talk about this before I talk about buying. In many accounts, we have limited the stock allocation for the enhanced fixed income to 35% or less, while the majority of accounts are more balanced between 40 to 55%. If you recall in my past newsletters, conference calls, and coffee with Dr. Steve, I have stated that I thought the stock market valuations were stretched, overbought, and overvalued. In response, I had lowered the bond, the stock ratio from approximately 65% for the typical balanced account to somewhere in the 50% range. On the whole, a week or two ago, I had trimmed even further and sold my Chinese stocks and bought the stock portion down another 5 or 6%. Each individual account will vary. So going into the market decline, I feel we are in good shape. And it would be hard for me to believe that our returns would be approaching the Dow Jones Industrial Average, even with bonds giving up approximately 5% of the year-to-date gains. Since I have to stay in compliance with SEC regulations, I can't give out specific numbers, although I do know what the numbers are for the portfolio as a whole. If you want to call me, I will be more than happy to give you your account decline numbers personally. But I can tell you that it's far below what the Dow Jones Industrial Average is. In the past month, I've had only 3 out of approximately 150 clients insist that I sell. One person was so scared he even yelled at me when I told him not to panic, and he was even a psychologist. Otherwise, the phones and emails have been relatively quiet. I just want to let you know that myself and my partners are thoughtful, deliberate, and are not panicking. As history has demonstrated, the big money is made at the bottom of the market, not the top. We have already started to buy beaten up but creditworthy municipal bonds. For example, the other day, Robert and I were looking at Houston Unified School District, which was even insured and was paying a 5% coupon, only going out 3 years. That's really unheard of. I tried to buy them very quickly, but somebody obviously beat me to the punch. But the other day we bought Sanger Unified School District bonds paying a 3.5% yield, tax-free both in California and federal, and it's due in 3 years. So we're going to look for credit opportunities as we find them. It might be too early to bottom fish for stocks, but we're not in the selling mood either. When the opportune time comes along, and it will, I would like to increase the stock allocation back to 65. But I'm fully aware how our clients' feelings are, and many of them are running scared. I don't take this lightly, and I truly understand. So if people don't want me to buy stocks, please just send me an email instructing me not to do so. Once all the stimulus kicks in after the pandemic recedes, I suspect that all this liquidity in the system will have an upside effect on stocks. I don't know how long it will take for us to fully recover. However, some folks at Alpine Macro and BCA Research think it's a V-shaped recovery, and if that's so, the time frame will be much shorter. Again, I have no idea if this will occur or not. If this pandemic persists or the economy really deteriorates, it will be much longer. One thing I do know is that the stock market will not go to zero, even close to it, and that it should recover nicely. If there is value, I'm a buyer. Having a bond and gold component, in my opinion, certainly helped lessen any loss in the total portfolio. This is why we have a balanced portfolio. And this will continue, and maybe those who insist that they have a total stock portfolio will learn the lessons of the 1930s and that of the 1920s. In my opinion, it is simply too dangerous to do so. One of the problems in the market is that everybody is running scared and liquidating at any cost, at any price. And with the advent of index funds, you simply liquidate all the stocks in the index by the push of a button because your broker or your investment advisor or your mutual fund company needs to liquidate those stocks to meet the redemption. And this accentuates the downturn in the market. And as the market downturns, the hedge funds have trigger points where they sell. And then we have this negative feedback loop. John Bogle, who was the founder of Vanguard, said that, and he was a big believer in index funds, but he said that it may have carried too far and that the index funds could cause real trouble in a big market decline and panic, and we're seeing evidence of that. Me, I would rather have individual stocks because I know that those stocks are solid and will be around for a long time and that I don't have to sell. And so I can keep those stocks. I can also manage the risk portion of the portfolio by buying stocks or reducing stocks, but keeping the stocks that I think will do well in the future. And that's the same with bonds. For example, if you had panicked and bought the 10-year Treasury when it was paying 0.31 of 1% last week and sold when it hit 1% towards the end of the week, you probably would have lost 40% of your money. We're just not going to do that. Once this debacle is finished, I suspect in a few years there will be a large increase in inflation. We will need to pivot the portfolio towards those securities that will do well in such an environment. As it turns out, some of our stocks fit that mold. We will start to increase our positions in Treasury inflation-protected securities and gold. We already have a position in gold and Treasury inflation-protected securities. But for right now, we are watching and waiting, building up our buy list and waiting for the right opportunity. As I said, it is most likely too early to bottom fish. You will be thankful that you stuck it out, and if all goes right, you should be handsomely rewarded. By the way, I don't see Warren Buffett selling anything. On buying, if you think the market is pricing in the worst case scenario, then it's okay to start to nibble. The good news is there's a massive global effort to find drugs and vaccines. More businesses and employees are operating remotely. The much needed medical supplies and equipment is busily being ramped up, and we have learned that some of the experiences of other countries can apply to us. But as usual, the politicians are causing a lot of the panic by some of the silly things that they are saying. The Chinese were very quick to clamp down. The stock market initially crashed in China, but it bounced back after new cases started to peak. And that might be a sign when the stock market here might stabilize, when the number of new cases might start to peak. The government took drastic action to curtail the problems in the economy, even though business conditions were still deleveraging. But since then, the Chinese stock market has been remarkably stable. If you believe that the lockdown and social distancing in Europe and North America will cause new cases to peak in the future, two to three weeks. This could end the panic, followed by several weeks of confined contagion, and this would be a good buying opportunity. The market, as of yesterday, has fallen 36%, and as of today, 26%. Another 20%, and it will look like the first leg down in the Great Depression between 1929 and 32. When there, the bear market, when there was no monetary support, no fiscal stimulus until 1933. Again, it's important to note that stocks gained about 50% from the low to the top of the rally in 1937, even though the bear market still had more declines ahead. This time, there is massive policy stimulus, which was not present in 1929-1932. As much as we would like to believe the optimistic scenario, we still believe there's a lot of uncertainty. As new cases rapidly rise and testing increases, we don't really know what the extent of the COVID virus is, how many people will be severely affected, how many people hospitalized, and unfortunately, how many people die. Uncertainty remains high, leaving room for further panic and stock prices to be volatile. I am optimistic. I am not sure that cases may peak in the next month, but I'm still optimistic. Great financial crisis, policy in most countries never got their finances under control, except Germany. Low interest rates for a decade have resulted in 50% of U.S. debt to be rated BB or lower, and many of them will turn to junk. This is one reason why the bond market has been so severe, but I'm happy to report to you that with one exception of a small bond, all our bonds are still investment grade. And this one exception is still investment grade as well. If the firepower of the Federal Reserve is combined with the open-ended fiscal deficit, this could soften the free fall of the economy and the stock market would ignite upwards. However, in the long run, all of this printing of money will come back to haunt us. To quote Benjamin Graham, who I've studied his investment principles that guide me today, through chances various, through all vicissitudes, we may make our way. I am happy now to answer any of your questions, and we'll be posting this text in case you would like to reread the transcript in the next few days. The other thing before I take the questions, I would like to thank all of you for your confidence in us and for the 99.9% of you who have not panicked to this point. I fully understand the concerns and heartburn that everybody has because my portfolio, which is balanced just like yours, are in the same stocks as you have. And my portfolio has gone down substantially as well, and that doesn't make me feel great. But I've had a long experience in the markets and have a lot of work in either graduate school or study to know that we will eventually recover from this. How long, I don't know. So now let me open up to questions.
I will now unmute the line so you can all ask your questions, but please, please be considerate of the noise level to keep it down so everyone can hear the questions and answers. One moment while I unmute the lines.
The conference has been unmuted.
The lines are now unmuted. Please go ahead with your questions to Stephen.
Hi, Stephen.
Rick Curley, have the question?
Yeah, you go ahead. You go
excellent.
First.
Excellent. Moisha.
Okay, Moisha.
Excellent.
Next question.
Jackie.
Bill Evans. I agree. That was an excellent presentation, and I'm glad that you're not selling. I agree with the philosophy of hanging in there in bad times. The period 1929 to 1932, isn't it also true that... Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
During that period, a big mistake that they made was that they... I'm getting a lot of noise.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise. Can you keep the noise down? Bill, repeat your question.
Okay, just Steve, if you can hear me, the answer to the question is, wasn't the mistake that was made in the period 1920 to 1932 that they were too protectionist about the economy? They raised interest rates, and they slapped tariffs on a whole lot of goods in 1930 with Smoot-Hawley. And we're not doing that now. We've lowered interest rates, and they're printing money. They were afraid to do that in that period, weren't they?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So in the 1930s, they actually raised interest rates from below 3% to 3.5%, and they kept money restricted because of the outflow of gold out of the United States, and because the Great Britain devalued the pound and came off the gold standard. And the Federal Reserve was worried about the outflow of gold in the United States, so to keep gold in the U.S., because they were on the gold standard, they raised interest rates. But in contrast, now the Federal Reserve said, we're going to do whatever it takes. They backstopped the commercial paper market that funds the money market account. They opened the window where banks can borrow because companies are now drawing down their lines of credit, so banks are running out of money to loan. But the Federal Reserve said that banks can borrow unlimited at the window. Then the Federal Reserve is starting to buy corporate bonds, municipal bonds, and trying to backstop that. And then they're flooding the money with QE. It's entirely different. And eventually, as we saw in 2019, when the Fed did QE and lowered interest rates, the market responded, and it's just a matter of time before the market responds again.
Well, I did.
Okay, any other questions?
Yeah, hi, Stephen. This is Daniel.
Hey, Dan.
I have two questions. One is the with all the money being pumped into the economy right now, and given that we have already had record high deficits, not to even mention the national debt, what strategies are there to against inflation?
So that's a good question. Right now is the print the money strategy and kick the can down the road. I mean, that's when I said all this money printing is going to come back to haunt us. Because the debt is unsustainable. But it's like one of my doctors said, okay, you're sick now. We know we're going to give you these pills. We know there's side effects, but let's worry about that down the road. Let's just cure what's going on now. And I think that's what the government is going to do. Yeah, I'm very worried about that money could be worthless down the road. But, you know, by that time, we'll have pivoted.
Okay. So my second question was your observation that utilities are probably safe because with everybody staying at home, they're using electric power that they normally wouldn't use during the day. But given that business and industry are closed or closing, you know, Ford and GM have shuttered their factories, I think Chrysler too, and others, all the small businesses, restaurants, and non-essential stores have closed, and I would think they would be major power consumers. So would residential power usage actually outweigh business and industrial use?
Well, that's a good question. For sure, commercial usage is going to go down. There's no doubt about that. But residential usage is going to go up, and that's more profitable for the power company. So, because commercial users pay less. But, you know, of course, if this thing goes on long enough, Or if some politician says you don't have to pay your utility bill, then, of course, the dividends won't be safe.
Okay.
Steve, I have a question.
Like in New York, the governor could make the whole financial crisis worse by ordering banks, state banks, not federally chartered banks, that where homeowners don't have to pay their mortgage for a while. Well, that's kind of stupid in a sense. I feel bad for the homeowners. If they don't have the money, they can't pay. Maybe they should just not foreclose. But all those mortgages are packaged in pools, and you could upset the pools and destroy the pools have a credit.
It's the end that you can't talk about.
All the politicians are playing the populist stuff so they can get the votes, but they don't think things through.
Mm-hmm.
Next question.
Well, this is Bill Evans again, Steve. On that point, isn't the essence of what you're really saying is that there is such a thing as excessive protectionism, and that an old-fashioned recession for a few months might be a dose of what we all need, is so that people are a little more careful about money, and then we ride it through, rather than the idea that everybody's going to get it fixed for them. There's things we have to learn from what we just did. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
School of thought that I was taught in economics, but the politicians, they're populists. So what they're going to do is they're going to just do what they think is going to get them elected. Theoretically, what should happen is a recession wipes out all the projects and all the stupid things that should have never been built, all the dumb companies that floated IPOs that should have never been floated. And destroys them, and then you pick up from anew. But that's not how the politicians are going to play this game. I don't disagree there. But I think what the Fed's going to do is they're going to do whatever it takes, and I think once the politicians in Washington wake up, they're going to do it. We're just going to have to look carefully at the inflationary impact at some point and pivot.
Steve, this is I have a question. This is Steve.
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Can you comment on the ramifications of the explosion of unemployment that's likely to happen, and how that will affect the real estate market and small businesses regenerating? Because
I'd say
60% of the people. 60% of the people I know have been laid off already.
I have no idea, Steve. That's one of the unknowns. I just don't know. Hopefully the government will get their act together and they'll extend unemployment insurance, and maybe they'll give people $1,000 like they're planning. You know, we call that helicopter money. And that's one of the sad things about this whole thing. I mean, it's good. It'll save all our bacon. But it's helicopter money. You just drop tons and tons of money out of a helicopter. They're printing money with no abandon. There's no way this can't be inflationary. But to answer your question directly, Steve, I have no idea. And honestly, nobody else does either.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Steve, can you look up about the election and what, if any, impact it will have on the market? What do you think about
that? Could you repeat that question, but speak a little louder?
Yeah, the question is the upcoming election. And obviously there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts. If Trump is successful or looked at as being successful during this virus war, if not, we've basically got a Biden-Trump election coming up. And what do you see on either side of that come November?
That's a good question, Bob. Today we got a special alert from my friends at Alpine Macro, and they basically said that Trump has a 35% chance of winning because of, there's been no incumbent president outside of Teddy Roosevelt who got reelected when there was a crisis, a pandemic, or a recession. So they said, you know, Trump is going to really try to turn it around, the economy, and that's why he said today, okay, we can't close down the country. We got to get moving, even though he realizes people might get sick, which is probably the wrong thing to do. But, again, I'm no expert. But he might try to run as a wartime president and use this crisis that, you know, it'd be foolish to change right now while we're doing this. And if he does that, he might have a better chance. But from what Alpine and BCA say, right now Biden would win.
I hope so.
And what impact would that have?
I don't think it would have any effect on the stock market. I mean, he's a pretty moderate kind of guy.
Okay.
Steve, hi, it's Michelle. I didn't know if you followed any of the models that Imperial College is doing in London. Their data is what made Boris Johnson put in Griffin Ford's blog in the UK. And according to their data, which they're the specialists, if Trump follows mitigation versus suppression and he opens everything by Easter, the healthcare system will collapse and millions of people will die. The model of that is, well, that's okay, because then we'll all get the virus. Those of us that live will be immune to it, and then life goes on. But the problem with that model, they're saying, is that this virus mutates so quickly that it will not be that's the end of it, and millions of people will be dead, versus the suppression model, which is where we keep these social distancing and, you know, as much as we can, keep these guidelines in effect, and we don't overwhelm the healthcare system because we don't have millions of people sick at the same time, and that, in essence, does buy us time. It does just give us time to come up with a vaccine and hopefully save lives. But it seems like, from what Trump said today in his press conference, that he wants everything open by Easter. And I think if that happens and our healthcare system collapses, right now we only have 50,000 ICU beds in the entire country. We probably need 3 million. I think if he does that, I don't see how anybody could vote for this one. It will just truly, truly be tragic. And if anybody wants to look at this report, it is the data that made Boris Johnson change his tune in the UK. And it's very,
well,
very comprehensive.
Well,
so are
well,
you prepared
Michelle,
for Model A or Model B? I guess that's what I was asking you. You guys listen to these
well, Michelle, I've done enough graduate work with a PhD to know that there's a lot of flaws in models because of the input, but regardless, everybody else has an opinion. That model has an opinion. Everybody else, you know, there's 50 other opinions. I read one opinion today saying it's not going to be so bad. The truth is, nobody really knows. I don't know. The model doesn't know. No, Boris Johnson doesn't know. Nobody knows. You can only go, you can't go with the unknowns. You can only go with the knowns. So I don't know. You know, that model could be very, very correct, but I'm not, I just can't, you know, I just don't know.
Well, no, but they're taking their model off.
I can't manage with an unknown, and even if it is a great depression, you know, we've looked at our worst-case scenario. That's just my opinion.
No, but it does make sense if everybody gets sick at once because all the guys.
Well, it doesn't make sense because we don't know if it's true or not.
Well, we see the model that was used in China, right? I mean, that's what they're going off of. Are
well,
the
everybody has a different opinion. You know, everybody has their own interpretation.
Well, that's, I guess,
any other question? Any other question?
Hey, Steve, it's Jim McKelvey.
Yeah, hey, Jim.
So I heard what you had to say. It sounds like, you know, we need to hold on. It's going to be a bumpy ride. So the question I had was, right now, it's just that what everybody can tell is we're going to recover. We don't know. We simply don't know how long it's going to take. We don't know how quickly, how sharp or deep a recovery it will be. In other words, you know, you look at the old data instead, and it shows the various declines, and then they always come back. It's just a question of how that'll be a function of how bad the virus is, right?
Yeah, so to answer your question is, look, we really don't know. But, you know, let's say you sold, you know, let's say people panicked yesterday and sold, right? Then they would have missed the 11% upturn today and would say, oh, my God, why did I do that? I mean, there's going to be a rally here probably once the stimulus package. And if people want to sell, then they should sell into the rally, right? Because it's just not worth it to them if they're too nervous or too scared to hold on for the long term. I mean, eventually it'll recover. And Michelle might be right. Most of us may be dead. Who knows, right? But
well, Santa Clara, they started in March 5th.
I don't really need to know. Anyway, I mean, we don't know. But my inclination is to hold. If people are super nervous and they want to sell out, wait till there's a substantial rally where at least we can reduce the loss.
Yeah, that's just what I wanted to confirm. Listening to you tonight, I don't have any intention of wanting to get rid of anything. I just wanted to confirm that that's generally what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for attending tonight. I appreciate everybody's attendance and evening. Just remember, follow me on Twitter. Watch Coffee with Dr. Steve. We're going to have a video tomorrow. And if you have any questions, just give me a call. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Bye.
Thank you.
Give me a call,
thanks,
okay?
Steve.